Bill's essay that was published in the Grapevine of January 1953. And it goes as follows. It's called Emotional Sobriety. I think that many oldsters who have put our AA booze cure to severe but successful tests still find they often lack emotional sobriety. Perhaps they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA, the development of much more real maturity and balance, which is to say, humility, in our relationships with ourselves, with our fellows, and with God. Those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, and perfect romance, urges quite appropriate to age 17, prove to be an impossible way of life when we are at age 47 and 57. Since AA began, I've taken immense wallops in all these areas because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. My God, how painful it is to keep demanding the impossible, and how very painful to discover, finally, that all along we have had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round. How to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result, and so into easy, happy, and good living. Well, that's not only the neurotic's problem, it is the problem of life itself for all of us who have got to the point of real willingness to hew to right principles in all our affairs. Even then, as we hew away, peace and joy may still elude us. That's the place so many of us AA oldsters have come to. And it's a hell of a spot, literally. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. I believe so because I begin to see many benighted ones, folks like you and me, commencing to get results. Last autumn, depression, having no really rational cause at all, almost took me to the cleaners. I began to be scared that I was in for another long chronic spell. Considering the grief I've had with depressions, it was not a bright spot. I kept asking myself, why can't the 12 steps work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right, but why did it not work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionist dreams and specifications, I had fought for them. And when defeat came, so did my depression. There was not a chance of making the outgoing love of St. Francis a workable and joyous way of life until these fatal and almost absolute dependencies were cut away. Because I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never before been so starkly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, indeed, upon any act of circumstance whatsoever. Then only could I be free to love as Francis did. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions I saw were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love and expressing love appropriate to each relation in my life. Plainly, I could not avail myself to God's love until I was able to offer it back to Him by loving others as He would have me. And I couldn't possibly do that so long as I was victimized by false dependencies. For my dependencies meant demand, a demand for the possession and control of the people and the conditions surrounding me. While those words, absolute dependence, may look like a gimmick, they were the ones that helped to trigger my release from my present degree of stability and quietness of mind, qualities which I am now trying to consolidate by offering love to others regardless of the return to me. This seems to be the primary healing circuit, an outgoing love of God's creation and his people, by means of which we avail ourselves of his love for us. It is most clear that the real current can't flow until our paralyzing dependencies are broken, and broken at depth. Only then can we possibly have a glimmer of what adult love really is. If we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependence and its consequent demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live in love. We may then be able to gain emotional sobriety. Of course, I haven't offered you a really new idea, only a gimmick that has started to unhook several of my own hexes at depth. Nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I have been a quiet place in the bright sunshine. And that was by Bill Wilson. And so I'm gonna mute you guys. The chat will be only with the host. If so, if there's a problem, you can talk to us. You will get a chance to chat. We'll open it up in the breaks. And I am so delighted to introduce you today to Paula and to Carla. Carla's from California. Paula is from Illinois, and they will be doing a workshop on emotional sobriety. And so I will let them talk to you and introduce the workshop. Guys, it's up to you. Thank you.
Right. Good morning, everybody. My name's Carla, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm here with my friend Paula, and who I just adore. I don't know, we met a few years ago, and we've just been increasingly growing together as time goes by, and I'm just so grateful for her to be in my life. And so we talked about how we would do this today, and we're really basically going to take turns, but if I may stop every once in a while and ask her if she wants to add something to that. We're both learning together and continuing to grow. My sobriety date, September 25th, 1987, and she is several years longer sober than I am. So our perspectives are going to be probably reflect some of that too. But I'm so delighted to have somebody to walk through this continued growing period. You know, people are staying sober now. Bill Wilson, I don't know, was 33 or 34 years sober when he passed. So there are people, you know, Clancy just died after having over 60 years of sobriety. And there were others who had over 60 years of sobriety when they passed away. And so we are continuing to, and God bless the young people. I sponsor somebody who got sober when she was the second time when she was 16, and she's now got 32 years of sobriety. And so, boy, she's gonna maybe one day be talking about having 70, 75 years of sobriety. And so it's some of it's uncharted territory. Anyway, I'm grateful for my friends who, even sponsorship has changed over time. You know, I have a sponsor still, and I am a sponsor, but my reliance changes, and my relationship with the truth has changed. Even if I don't like it, sometimes I welcome it more. I'm more able to lean into it and ask for it. And people like my sponsor and my good friends like Paula and a couple of others who would be willing to tell me the truth of the hard truth, the difficult, uncompetitive, uncomparable truth, where they thought maybe I was being harming myself or harming others by my behavior and even thought process. So anyway, I love that Bill wrote that letter. I needed to read it again when I was about 21 years sober. I had just gotten married, and I had just been laid off another job. It was during a recession, and I'd had a six-figure job about a year before that, and then came in, you know, and all kinds of changes were happening. And I come from a time where, and I used to hear this and I used to love it. I don't hear it so much anymore, but they used to say that when you sober up a horse thief, what you have now is a sober horse thief, and that there was so much more work to do. And I'm just of the mind, it's been my experience, and I can only share from my experience that the moment that I started to take these steps, and especially surrender to the inventory, the written inventory, and then step 6 and 7, and then start to make amends, did I begin my quest into emotional sobriety. Now, it's taken a long time, and on any given day, it can still be iffy, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous is definitely more than just stopping drinking. However, it was the impetus that got me here. And what emotional sobriety has brought me to, and what emotional sobriety has brought me to is that Alcoholics Anonymous is part of a great whole, which is the world community. And Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to go out into the world and live as a regular human being. You've enabled me to stand on a secure, sober ground so that I can go out there and see how I am more alike the non-alcoholic than I am separate from. And Chuck C. used to talk about there being one problem, and that was conscious separation, just only one problem, that being conscious separation from God and from each other, and only one solution, which is conscious connection or conscious contact with God and with each other. But that's not just for alcoholics. It's not just for people, Al-Anons who lived with alcoholics. It's not just for that particular neurosis. It's for the whole world. We don't have a separate spirit than everybody else, and alcoholics are definitely not a different species. I do have a different condition, and I need very much to understand how I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. But having understood that, then I know what the stakes are if I don't continue to grow in other ways. And so that's just been my experience. And I was talking with my friend Matthew yesterday about this, and it's just an observation, but I run into it as I live my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am one of those people who at many times have been privileged to spend most of my time or a lot of my time doing this work, you know, 12-step work and being in meetings or conferences or whatever, just exposed on every way. But that is not the end. What we're doing here in this little conference is not our end. It's our means. This is our inspiration. This is not the work. This is, we're going to leave here, and then we're going to go back and out and do our own homework. We're going to live our own life and apply these principles and learn how, what this looks like coming from me or through me, you know, how self is operating in my life so that it can be recognized and relinquished to this power greater than myself. And before I get too far off on that, I always feel like I need to talk about why I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. What am I doing here in Alcoholics Anonymous? September 25th, 1987, that wondrous day without which I wouldn't be sitting here with you at all. I couldn't have what I have today if I hadn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to get sober first. It was the huge block. I started drinking young. Alcohol very quickly became my spirituality, and it became my growing up muscle, and it became the thing that made me feel buffered from you and the thing that made me feel connected to you all at the same time. Why wouldn't I drink that? I know no better way to describe my relationship with alcohol than that. It was the great counterfeit. It was the great substitute for having to do the homework that was required or feel the feelings that was required to have any kind of relationship with this power greater than myself that I really believed in, but could never, ever stay connected with. And so alcohol gave me the feeling that I was connected. It gave me the feeling that I did the emotional work. It gave me the feeling that I was connected in spirit. Now, alcohol doesn't do that for everybody. So not everybody becomes alcoholic. And when I got to AA, I might have told you that it was my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family that made me alcoholic, you know, and now times have changed, and I found out that gave me an inventory. But I look around and I see people who lived, you know, Criminal Minds kind of childhoods, you know, and I'm sure that in Al-Anon, some of you did too. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mother was had a long relationship with prescription pills as well. And so there was all that went with it. But when I look outside of that, and you, all you have to do is look at the news and see, you know, what other people have had to overcome, and certainly they didn't become alcoholic. There was a little girl many years ago, I think she was about 8 years old, 8 or 9, and all she did in her country was say that she wanted to get an education and become a doctor one day, and somebody shot that girl. Somebody shot her because she spoke heresy, and yet she didn't become alcoholic. That's a terrible, horrendous way to grow up, and yet she didn't become alcoholic. So all of these, and the reason that I'm kind of making these large distinctions is because all these years later, these crippling ideas that we keep as alcoholics, that we can never grow beyond this alcoholism. Alcoholism is always chasing us around. It is always dark thoughts. And any dark thought I has is the alcoholism trying to get me. And I'm making a little bit of light of it, but in that, I can never be free of that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body when I perpetuate that kind of thinking. And I don't have to look any further than my big book and the instructions on steps 10 and 11 to find out that my thinking does get better. It's a promise that I come to that place of neutrality first with respect to alcohol, that I'm not chasing it and I'm not running away from it. I'm in that place of neutrality that it talks about. I look at it, I say, nope, I can't drink that stuff. That's like drinking a can of Raid for me. I understand that, fully conceded to that. And yet the obsession to drink alcohol was lifted as well. And so to continue to grow for me through these steps, and incidentally, the essay right after the essay that Bill wrote on emotional sobriety, the next frontier, is practice step 11, that this is how we come to experience, understand, and be able to live in emotional sobriety, and to grow and to welcome these things that are so uncomfortable. And first I'll talk about what I'm doing here in Alcoholics Anonymous in case there's somebody new, because you got to know what I know that happens to be at stake for me if I don't continue to practice this. And that is just simply that when I discovered what alcohol would do for me, I couldn't leave it alone. And not because I had any kind of ego, like, oh, I can outdrink anybody, or I kind of, you know, that was a bonus, but it wasn't always that I set out to drink more and more and more. But what happened was at some point was, when I'd pick up a drink, no matter what it was I wanted to do, whether I planned on sitting there and just drinking all day, or what was worse was when I didn't plan on sitting there and drinking all day, you could have told me that there was a $1 million check across town sitting there waiting for me. But if I started to drink, I might or might not get up from that bar stool and go pick up that $1 million check. And that's when I really began to suspect that I might be down for the count. I had a little girl. I started to drink early, and I left home, and I got locked up early, and you know, I spent time in a mental hospital. I had been locked up before in juvenile hall and places like that, and then I was supposed to spend 2 weeks in this mental hospital, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved in. And here was another observation about, you know, our mental state. The doctor, Dr. Silkworth and Bill Wilson, in the chapter The Doctor's Opinion, I think it was Bill that wrote this, where he said, you know, it wasn't just that we were outright mental defective. Some of us may or may not have been. Some of us may or may not have been maladjusted to life. Some of us may or may not have been in that state. But what we do share is that allergy to alcohol, that abnormal reaction to alcohol that condemns us to drink, to get out of control, and to drink way more than I ever intended once I start to drink. And then that horrible obsession that it causes for me to continue to drink alcohol. But I looked around this mental hospital, and it was not a treatment center for kids. It was a mental hospital. And even girls my age, they had manic depression and they had schizophrenia, and some of them sat and they talked to the walls. and they never became alcoholic. Why? Because alcohol just didn't do it for them. And so when we're talking about a state of emotional sobriety, those things are not the qualification for my being an alcoholic. And that's why we have two or 300 other fellowships that use these same steps, but are not necessarily alcoholism. And I talk about this partly to begin to try to recoup or regain our singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then just something hit me a few years ago, and I was afraid for a long time to say it out loud, though, is that there are some emotions that I have that I share with the non-alcoholic. And so emotional sobriety, what that has finally done for me is helped me to grow up most of the time. And if I'm not being grown up, to at least recognize that I need to. and yet, so many people who are non-alcoholic out in the world share those things. We share those foibles. We share those frailties. We share those dependencies. And for me, the first thing that's at stake for not recognizing and relinquishing and growing through these hobbling dependencies is what's at stake is eventually I could end up in such darkness that I end up picking up a drink of alcohol. But it's the emotions themselves we share with the world. And I'm not spiritually significant or spiritually, we come in and I hear so much of the time that, you know, too bad they don't have what we have, you know, too bad they don't have a program. But many people do out there. Many people have a spiritual program that they live by, that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was lucky enough to get a hold of too. So I keep coming back to this. At some point, and I lived on the street, and I, you know, and I love that my sponsor talks about this. You know, the insanity of alcoholism wasn't necessarily where I went or any of that kind of stuff, because she always says, you know, if you drank and took barbiturates like I did, you couldn't get past the living room couch. Yet, you know, that's alcoholism, you know. And so my insanity of all the violence and the, you know, running through people's lives and all of that kind of stuff, out on the road, being homeless, being all of those things, is not the insanity itself of alcohol. The insanity of alcoholism was that stone cold sober at any given time, I pick up that first drink knowing full well what might or might not happen. I pick it up and drink it anyway. And I had this little girl, and I was living up on top of a mountain in this old mining claim. And I had this little girl, and I had had enough therapy to know that you got to break the cycle of parenting. You got to become the parent you never had. And by that time, I was getting my clothes and shoes and the necessities of life out of a box behind a store in town. And I thought I was going to be a better parent than the one I had. And because I was delusional, and So I had this little girl, and alcoholism doesn't care who you love, and I had to leave her father because it was just too violent, and she got in the way of one of our fights. And my first legitimate work was in the bar business, and I drugged that kid over three states, and we ended up living in this little room that I was renting from my aunt, and I got a job in Hollywood about 30 miles away tending bar. And for me as an alcoholic, I thought, man, this is heaven. They were great people, great money. Any healthy person could have made a great living doing what I was doing. And here's where the alcoholism comes in. And that is, my daughter was almost 4 years old at the time. And every afternoon I'd kiss her goodbye and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood, and I'd get thirsty on the way, and I'd pull into my favorite watering hole and I'd order up a couple of drinks and I'd drink them down and I'd head off to the bar. And I'd go do my shift, and I'd come home in the wee hours of the morning and start over again. And one afternoon, I'd been, after months of doing this same thing, I kissed my daughter goodbye and I took off for the bar, and I stopped at the same watering hole and I drank those drinks. And this day I couldn't stop. No explanation, no particular thing wrong that day. One of my favorite stories in the Big Book is about Fred the accountant, who didn't have a cloud on the horizon. He wasn't having a bad weekend. His His business was going great. There was nothing wrong, nothing at all wrong, except that he walked in to the bar and he thought, maybe I'll have a highball. Maybe if I have a highball and call it a highball, it won't harm me this time. And then he drank, and then his life slipped through his fingers in a very, very short time. And so I'm sitting on the bar stool this afternoon, and nothing's wrong that afternoon. And I drank those drinks, and this time I couldn't stop. This time the knowledge that I needed to get up and go be responsible, and so that I could pay my bills and go to a job that I really like going to, so I could take care of the most important person in the world to me, was just not enough to overcome the phenomenon of craving that happens once I start to drink. Nor was the knowledge that my little girl, the most important person in the world to me, sitting at home waiting for her mommy, was just not enough to overcome the phenomenon of craving that happens once I start to drink. And so I sat on the bar stool that day and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And then you can fast forward just a few years later, and I did the very same thing all over again in another scenario with the most important person in the world to me. And for whatever reason, it was shortly after that that my next door neighbor was able to 12-step me and I was able to come in. But if you know about alcoholism, if you're an alcoholic like me, you understand that relationship with alcohol, that it doesn't matter who's standing in front of you or how fast I need to get somewhere. That I shared that story one time at a meeting, and this one woman shared after me and she said, well, I didn't just go sit on a bar stool and lose my daughter. I had a legitimate nervous breakdown. And I thought, well, okay, but if you understand alcoholism, I think my friend Carl puts it the best. He had his children in sobriety. And what he says is, I would never trade my kids away for the first drink, but I would darn sure trade them for the second. And if you're an alcoholic like me, you understand that. That's the effect that alcohol has on an alcoholic, not on everybody else. So that's what's at stake for me. And when I came rolling into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1987, this was what I had to deal with. My husband and I were we were fighting one more time. We used to settle our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever got to the gun first won. That's how we rolled. The cops were in the driveway one more time, and the kid was 10 years old. I had lost her for 4.5 years, and then I got her back. And then, you know, I weighed 110 pounds. I'm almost 6 feet tall, getting ready to lose the apartment, losing the husband, getting ready to lose the kid. I thought it was circumstances that had made me alcoholic. I had drank through them all before, and I was getting ready to drink through them again. And my next door neighbor 12-stepped me, and then that began my road. September 25th, 1987, I drank one time after 89 days, and then I was able to stay. And the reason I bring that here is that no matter where I go in the practice of that 11th step, and I'm infatuated with the mystery, and no matter how emotionally sober or spiritually fit I get, that part of me will never change. The fact that I'm allergic to alcohol will never change. And when they said allergy back then, they said abnormal reaction to alcohol. That meant that I didn't just throw up right away. It loved me. Alcohol loved me. And then it threw me away. But in the beginning, it was very easy to see progress. You know, I started paying rent more than a month in a row. I started showing up to work a month, more than a day at a time. You know, it was paying rent and putting food on the table and all that kind of thing. And so easy to see that I'm making progress. You know, when you show up at your meeting and everybody's like, yeah, there she is again, you know, and and it's very simple to, we take a bath and, you know, we're all cleaned up and yay. And then it gets more subtle. And for me, it felt like my sobriety was very front loaded with, I thought it was new trouble, but as I woke up, what I realized is I was just taking care of the business, the setup of the old trouble. My daughter was very, very angry. And by the time she was 11, I was almost 2 years sober. I was about a year and a half sober, I guess. And she was starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She'd been jumped into a gang and starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. And it was time for me to wake up, you know, and this is, this whole thing is a process of awakening, you know, and I, no matter how good I look going up to my meetings and dumping all the ashtrays and finding a place in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our first connection. If you're anything like me, it was my first connection. They were the first flimsy reeds that came into my life. But then it was time to take it home. And it says in our big book, not on page 165, it says on page 19 that a more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. And it was time for me to wake up, grow up some more. You know, this is not no time to rest on our laurels. It was time to wake up and find some help for this kid. She was angry. And I understood being that angry at that age. I did. And yet here I am in the same position that my mother and stepfather had been in, but I was a little more awake to what it was. You know, they never recovered. My mother died of end-stage liver disease about 13 years ago, and my stepfather passed away of lung cancer, but my baby brother died of drug addiction and alcoholism, and my little baby sister died of suicide at 17 years old. And she wasn't a drug addict or an alcoholic. She was just done. And so with no tie whatsoever to emotional sobriety, and she wasn't an alcoholic or addict or anything like that. But so here was my chance, and I recognized that intuitively. Maybe I didn't have the words for it, but I wanted to do something different. And I found a treatment center for her, and I drove those people crazy. You know, and somebody might call that not emotionally sober. I didn't know. I did the best I could. I showed up, and I tried to be there for my daughter. I showed up when they asked me to, and I stayed away when they asked me to. And all I knew is that you guys kept telling me that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. And little by little by little, I learned how to parent through the guilt. And for me, that was very valuable. Learning how to parent through the guilt. It would have been so easy just to let it be another alcoholic generation that just, you know, goes to hell because we don't know how to do the work and we're not willing to try. And being emotionally sober as well, you know, it's really, I take exception when I hear people say, well, you know, they don't walk like they talk. You know, well, how do we know? How do we know really that we just haven't bumped into somebody in a moment of time? You know, and then who am I to sit and think that I know how they are for the rest of their beings? You know, this is still a program of not what to do when it's their fault. You know, this is like, it comes back to me. Where are my faults and mistakes? Taking out of my mind the wrongs others had done and coming back to me. And maybe that, I don't know, you're not going to get a lot of other stuff from me, except that how I got here was from the springboard of what was laid out in the big book and amplified in the 12 and 12. And what the big book does too is it sends me to therapy. It sends me to books outside. It sends me to formal religion if that's what I want, or to science if that's what I am come to understand, but not instead of AA, in addition to. Because we get to grow up and we get to be well-rounded. And, you know, you enabled me to grow up and go vote, you know, now. And I find sweet irony in this. I know Paul has heard this before, I think, you know, and anybody who's heard this talk recently is just, but I know no better way to say it. And that's, you know, you taught me how to vote, but you don't want me coming in here and telling you how to vote. You know, you taught me how to have a business, but you don't want me coming in here and having my AA Carla business. You know, it's like, go out there and do it. You know, you taught me how to be infatuated with the mystery, with the spiritual mystery, and study all kinds of spiritual tradition, take deep dives and experience that with other people. And those people aren't alcoholic out there, not all of them, you know, and to go out there and find where I'm like them. But you don't want me coming back in here and telling you what you should be doing, how you should be doing it. That's spiritual maturity. And early on in the book, you know, Bill says that I used to take this the wrong way too. And he says that I used to take
let me read it for good.
There's a line in here that says, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. You know, and I used to, oh, you know, and just, lay myself onto the altar of, yes, we're going to go to any lengths to help all the newcomers right now, everywhere, you know, and what that meant was that at expense of taking care of self and just going out there and doing what Bill called two-stepping, really was not that I wasn't working the steps in between, but somewhere along the line got out of balance with what that really means. And then all I had to do was come to the page again, page 19 down at the bottom. It says, most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Then our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on the constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And tolerance in this instance, meaning that I make room for you and your point of view and your experience, and I listen to that, which ties in with that, with the contemplation that St. Francis laid out. And then I just found out, I don't know, a few months ago that St. Francis didn't even really write that, that somebody wrote, sort of took his conglomeration of ideas and wrote it down. But anyway, nevertheless, they're good ideas. And it just means to begin to make room for others' points of view, that it doesn't, I don't have to be right or wrong. And when I begin to grow out of this polarity, this polarized living where somebody's got to be right and somebody's got to be wrong, and I can then begin to make room and not have to, oh, and I sense it when I'm in that, when I feel that feeling in my solar plexus where I'm getting ready to compare and compete. and the thing is that if I, the consequences of that kind of thinking are, if I don't win, then I got to go away. You know, somebody's got to die. Somebody's got to go away. And then we're separate again. And that's not just me as an alcoholic. Certainly for me as an alcoholic, separating myself from Alcoholics Anonymous, eventually I can forget I'm an alcoholic. I've seen it happen. People with 12 good years, 20 good years, 30 good years, 40, 41, 41 good years of sobriety forget what's at stake here. So I'll never be so spiritually fit I can take a drink of alcohol in any form at all. But when I have really conceded to that, and I think it's very important, at least it's been important to me, our big book spends 51 pages on the first step. How important is that? Most of our book on the first step. Now, these steps apply with other things as the first half of the first step, but as an alcoholic, that first half of the first step is very important here to me. And I protect it through the taking of the rest of the steps. I don't want to get too far off of my beam here, but anyway. So my daughter came out, and I love that this God, this power that I call God for short, works in such a way that I do not have to be perfect in order to be effective. I do not. I can be exactly perfectly imperfect in this moment, and God will use wherever I am at the time with the people who need whatever that is, wherever that is, and we can help each other on our way. You know, I don't have to wait until I've achieved some kind of, you know, great status. And I've been, even with these conferences, you know, I used to think it was overly humble for Bobby Earle, who's just really said some wonderful things when I was new. I'd listen to his tapes but one thing that he used to say was, now don't get too caught up in what I say today, because I can change my mind walking out the door. And I hope that we leave room for that. And so I love in the essay on step six, you know, Father Dowling and Bill Wilson met in 1940, and Bill just had a few years of sobriety, and he was struggling and suffering, not just because he had alcoholism, but because he was trying to figure out how to make this thing they had found available to the rest of the world. They had a warehouse full of big books they were trying to get rid of, trying to get, you know, sold and out, distributed, and all of whatever questions that may have gone. And I like to use Bill Wilson as an example as well, too, because he's got this reputation, and I hear it all the time in the meetings that I go to in my home group, you know, where, you know, people with just a couple of years will say, yeah, Bill was the arrogant one and Dr. Bob was the humble one. And I think, you know, that's a real jump to, and we do it with lots of people, but I'll just use that for an example, you know, and I think we do a big jump just because somebody has a bigger personality, that perhaps they're the shyster and they're the bad one. And then Dr. Bob, because he was a little more reserved, you know, might've been the more humble one. You can be quiet and still egotistical, and you can be loud and humble, you know? And so anytime we take these labels, and becoming emotionally sober means that I stop to observe even these small judgments, these small contempts prior to investigation that I create. These are my ideas. These are whether or not they came from me, but the ones I buy into, you know, I have to recognize what I'm operating on, which is why I will still, and I stopped saying it for a while because I got scared and went through this growing up period too in AA, but I believe that yes, I needed to go through the steps with my sponsor. I still, a solitary self-appraisal doesn't always do the trick. Although that in a moment, a spot check 10th step will get me through. I will see how to do that preemptive 10th step, which is to breathe through my nose and to ask and to pause and to practice self-restraint and then walk through a situation. I am better at that than I ever was. But I'm also responsible to do my own homework. I'm also responsible to read my own big book. I'm also responsible, and it is my privilege to do my own work, not to just sit in a meeting and expect Joe over there to tell me how he did it and what he thinks the big book says. It's my responsibility to pick up this work and grow. And then when I discover something that doesn't sound quite like what the rest of the people are saying, to begin to talk about that and ask, not in a pounding, I want to be right thing, which I am very prone to do sometimes, because I get so afraid of never saying it that I'll jump out there in the bluster and then, you know, then I got to clean that up. But to be able to question these ideas that we get so locked onto. And emotional sobriety means sometimes, again, not sometimes, but again and again and again, being able to, or being willing to change my mind, to look at something differently. Isn't that what the fourth step and the 10th step inventories are? We're willing to look at this from an entirely different angle. And so things like, I'll always be alcoholic and I'll always be dark and I'll always have this horrible stuff going on in my head. That's just not true. And if I hadn't read my own big book, I might have believed that. And I still hear it. And I hear people say that we're more spiritually inclined. First, we're more spiritually dark than everybody else. And then when we get a few months sober, then we're like way more spiritually developed than anybody else. And I think, wait a second. We rent from them. We're in their basement. And, you know, just a little note. But I think we do ourselves a disservice. I know I was for a while, to think that I would be locked in this horrible state of darkness. We don't have to. But I've got to commit to meditation. I've got to commit to doing that work. Otherwise, I'm going to sit in a meeting and hope that you say something wonderful. And then we begin to develop idols and people that will do the work for us. And then, but I'm a terrible spectator, and maybe that's my blessing and my curse, you know, because I don't want to just sit and watch you have something wonderful. I want to have it too. And it started in the big book. It started in the big book for me. And what those were is the big book isn't a be all and end all. That came from somewhere else. That developed from somebody else practicing spiritual principles. And then Bill Wilson and the founders and the writers of the book put that together in a way that we as alcoholics could use it to not only get sober, but then learn how to grow spiritually. And not against alcoholism, but along with having alcoholism. And so, I started to say this, that when Bill and Father Dowling got together, it's Father Dowling in the essay on the sixth step in the 12 and 12 that says, anyone with enough willingness and honesty to try this step repeatedly is on their way to progress, something like that. That's a paraphrase. You'll have to read the book to see. But when he says that, you know, that key word repeatedly, I'm going to have to try this again. And anyway, I've just kind of laid the groundwork. I hope that wasn't too scattered, but I want to then the next time we get back together or that I come on, I want to hear Paula. And then when I come back, I'm going to lay out what that began to look like in the rest of my sobriety and see where we go from here. But if I can say nothing else, you know, that when Bill started talking about these hobbling demands that we make on life and on people, you know, when we started to learn about those, when we started to get sober. And so this is not another language. This is a continuing of the original language we learned when we got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I suspect Al-Anon. So thanks for letting me share. I think we're going to have a little break and some chat, and then Paula's going to come on and share with us. So thanks.
Thank you, Carla. Hold on, you guys. If you want to unmute yourself and give her a little hand, go for it. Give Carla a shout out. You can unmute yourself.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you.
That was excellent. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Carla. Thank you very much. Very well done.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you. Your top cookie.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you. Thank you.
So what do you want to do, Paula? Take a 5 or 10 minute break and then continue.
I'll
with
take you. Like a 10 minute break, and Carl and I were kind of thinking that if, you know, people wanted to say something or I guess ask something, that's all fine too. Or what do you think?
Carla, I cannot thank you enough. I am 39 years sober, and I'm exactly what you described right now. It's uncovering, discovering, and discarding. And God bless you. I really do thank you for sharing what you shared exactly the way you shared it.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
There we go.